This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this Memorial Day, we wish you a bit of idleness, a lazy afternoon at the beach with a good book and a tube of sunscreen, a position at the grill greeting friends and flipping burgers, or maybe just some quality time on the couch. After all, this is the unofficial start of summertime, when the living is easy. Not that laziness is exactly in vogue in our culture. News items continually bemoan how we all work longer hours and take less time off. At the other end of the paper, lifestyle articles beguile us with new ways to fill our time. Host a Tuscan dinner party, shape your own topiaries, discover 15 more kinds of yoga. As the man says, we can sleep when we're dead. Later in the program, we'll visit Kansas City, Missouri, and ceremonies at the National World War I Memorial, and your letters. But first, for the chronically busy today, we focus on some constructive advice for not doing very much at all. And, of course, we're going to need your help. Is idleness a pastime for you, a goal, or a nemesis? How is it best achieved? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And our guest is Tom Hodgkinson, the founding editor of The Idler magazine and author of the just-published book, How to Be Idle. He joins us from the studios of the BBC in Exeter, England, where it is also coincidentally a holiday, the inspirationally and romantically named May Bank Holiday. Tom Hodgkinson, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're working on a holiday, a holiday evening, no less. Shouldn't that be a breach of the Idler's Code?
Well, I think it's my duty as a revolutionary idler to go out there and preach the message, even if it does mean a bit of extra work for me.
And they're on time, too, for which we're very appreciative. How did you spend your bank holiday?
Well, this morning we went out for... We lived near the sea, so we went out for a walk across the cliffs and down to the beach. There were dolphins playing in the bay. And then our local village had its annual village fete, which is called the Paracombe Revels. And there was karaoke and Elvis competitions and...
The traditional karaoke, yes.
It's like a sort of ancient village fete, but mixed in with some modern attractions. Completely free, and it was great fun.
The problem, you write in your book, the problem with modern holidays is that they are such bloody hard work. What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm sure it's the same in the States, but my worry is that we're encouraged to fill our work time with harder and harder work and, you know, busier and busier schedules, longer and longer days. When it comes to our sort of rare vacations, there seems to be a vogue for these sort of what are called activity holidays. Bungee jumping, kite surfing, snowboarding, and this kind of thing, the sort of extreme, take it to the max kind of Pepsi Max holidays. And to me, that's a worrying trend. I mean, I think we work hard enough as it is, and surely a holiday or vacation should really just be for doing nothing.
Just for doing nothing. It sounds like a little bit about the way you describe the rest cure in another part of your book, or this one on sickness.
Well, that's right. One of the things that I find quite depressing about modern medicine is that they prescribe you drugs which seem to be designed to get you back to work as soon as possible. Now, in England, we have a medicine called Lemsip.
Oh, I remember it well.
Yeah, and this is like a sort of anti-cold, anti-flu medicine. Now, their latest advertising campaign is geared around the idea that if you take any time off work because of illness, some other guy is going to take your job while you're out of the office. So it's based on these kind of feelings of fear and insecurity, and their strapline is stop snivelling and get back to work. Now, in the olden days, you know, I was reading about the history of medicine in the 18th century. The prescription to get better was take a lot of time off doing nothing, you know. And even in Victorian times, there was this idea of the rest cure. So if you had a slight cold or were feeling a little bit under the weather, you went along to your doctor and he said, absolutely no work for at least a month. You must sit on the south coast and do absolutely nothing.
It sounds like utter bliss, though maybe a little boring.
Well, I think what you find as an idler is that... you find that you've got your own inner resources and you can start to find things that you want to do when you're doing nothing in the eyes of the world. I mean, it's when, for example, a writer or a musician appears to be doing the least, perhaps he's just staring out the window, that he might actually be most deeply immersed in his work. And, you know, I think of John Lennon, who celebrated his own laziness. He didn't sort of hide it or try to push it away. And thank goodness for us, he didn't get a 9-to-5 job. And he celebrated his own laziness in songs like I'm Only Sleeping and later Watching the Wheels Go Round.
And as you point out, in a protest for world peace, spent a week in bed.
In bed, yeah. He was, you know, he was the ultimate consummate idler. But he does embody to me the paradox, actually, that often idlers can be very successful. And often I think it's actually their idleness that leads to the success, because it's when you're idle and when you're doing nothing and when you're sort of prone and relaxed that good creative ideas can come into your mind. I don't just mean for, you know, writing or songs, but for anybody in any sort of profession, you can have great business ideas or ideas on how to improve your life. And I think we're in danger of losing the sense of enjoying being idle and appreciating it as a sort of important part of life. And the book is really a defence of that kind of thing, and an attack on the idea that we have to push laziness away and somehow feel guilty about it.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. John's with us on the line from Tucson, Arizona.
Good afternoon. I called a comment on the term of idleness, and I prefer to use the term unstructured time. And it's time that is purely mine, nothing really planned, just the ability to just to be. And whether it's lying on the couch or sitting, perhaps reading a book, maybe sitting at the beach. Not too many beaches out here, but it's valuable because, again, that's where inspiration comes from, and that's really where I find rejuvenation. I'm an adult, single parent of four, and they're all grown, and me time is very important. Not to have a lot of necessity built into it.
Well, for that. Tom Hodgkinson, idleness is the devil's workshop, and idle mind is the devil's workshop. The idle rich. Idle doesn't have a great reputation.
No, and you have to sort of wonder why this is, because actually in Greek and Roman times, the people at the top of society were the most idle, because, of course, they had a slave society, you know, and it was looked down upon to work. And even in England, until quite recently, if you were one of the people right at the top, you know, one of the aristocrats, and you were forced to work because you'd lost your estates, it was very embarrassing to say that you worked. So somehow things have got switched around. But there has been this sort of attack on idleness at the same time going on throughout history. And I think at different times, the idlers, or what I call the botherers, have been in the ascendant. And I think probably since the Industrial Revolution, and certainly since the rise of the sort of Protestant ethic, and in the States I blame Benjamin Franklin for promoting a new kind of work ethic. The idea of hard work has been in the ascendant, but at other times in other societies, the idea that it's noble to be lazy and to lie around doing nothing has been the dominant idea. So obviously I'm in favour of the latter.
John, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. For people whose work is their passion, idleness can be difficult to achieve. Award-winning chef Cindy Hudson owns and operates five restaurants across the country, including the chain Ortanique in Washington, D.C., Miami, and Las Vegas. She also owns a coffee import company. She's the mother of two teenagers, in the process of designing two more restaurant projects. Chef Hudson is on the phone with us now from Miami, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I understand you're taking a mini vacation this weekend. Where are you, and what are you doing?
I actually didn't go too far, and I left Coral Gables and went 15 minutes north to South Beach, and I have my daughter with me on a two-day mom-daughter weekend.
And so you're just taking time to do nothing and be with each other and spend some time alone?
Yes.
And how are you? What are you doing any activities at all?
Well, not really, except sunning, and I'm having a few cocktails, and we're eating well. And the gentleman earlier said that it's unstructured idle time. Actually, I have to structure my idle time, or else I don't enjoy it properly. You know, I have to make sure, okay, you take time to just hang out. I'm here with my daughter. We have a great time, great relationship, and not do any work. And
well, when you're on a weekend like that, you work in the restaurant business. Do you cook, or do you send out for some sandwiches?
Well, while I'm here on these 2 days, I've done nothing but critique the food. I've been critiquing the food and getting new ideas, because that's my best learning experience, is experience other restaurants.
Well, let me ask you about what Tom Hodgkinson was just saying, though, that the, you know, some of the best creative moments are when we're in idle time, when we're in the shower or walking on the beach.
You know, when I'm really hot and sweaty, I think of something that'll cool me down to put into my stomach, or, you know, something to enjoy a drink, whether it be a exotic cocktail or what have you. Yeah, I can think of great things to bring back to my restaurant when I go home.
Mm-hmm. But it's all grist for the mill, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
So it's difficult to get away from, clearly in your life, it's not a routine, it's a passion.
It is, and I'm driven by it. So, therefore, everything I do pretty much revolves around my family and the passion for my business to be able to excel with my family.
So, does your family have a hard time keeping up with you?
Well, my daughter keeps telling me, Mom, you're not doing one more thing. You're not doing one more thing. And then when she spends 2 days like this with me, she says she understands what drives me, and she understands a lot more than she's 15, so she'll look at me and go, oh my God, I know what I have to do to survive and succeed as well.
I wonder, do you ever see yourself in a place where you could slow down a little bit more permanently?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think I can slow down more permanently in a few years, but I'm not ready for that yet because there's just too many ideas welling up inside me, and and like you said earlier, it's my passion. So I just know that I can pass something on to my kids, and I know that they're inspired by me. In the beginning, they hated me for it, but now they're inspired by what I do.
And when do you have to go back to doing it? Tomorrow?
Yes. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, I'll be back there in the kitchen.
Well, have a great rest of your day. We appreciate your sharing part of it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Cindy Hudson is a chef and the owner of Ortanique chain of restaurants, and she was kind enough to join us today from Miami. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we're exploring the dimensions of idleness. The 13th century Japanese monk Yoshida Kenko, in his work Essays in Idleness, wrote, "To sit alone in the lamplight with a book spread out before you and hold intimate converse with men of unseen generations, such is a pleasure beyond compare." In this age when yoga is practically a competitive sport and multitasking is a verb, how do you court idleness? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Tom Hodgkinson, the author of How to Be Idle, an hour-by-hour guide to the loafer's day. And Tom, I have to say, I read the book and distressingly found no time set aside for midday talk radio programs.
No, I'm sorry about that. Well, maybe there'll be an updated edition in the future, and I'll be able to rectify that, glaring omission.
You do attack serious news radio in the morning, and
yeah.
Also an institution for which used to put bread in your mouth, the newspaper, you seem particularly irritated with.
Well, what I find with a lot of modern media is that they tend to produce this kind of sense of anxiety and fear in you. The headlines are very negative. The headlines are generally about wars and things that the politicians are doing. Certainly in the UK, we have something called the Today Programme, which is a very sort of combative way to start the day. It starts at about 6 in the morning. And for a certain kind of person, you feel it's your duty to listen to it. It's your duty to make yourself aware of all the terrible things that are going on in your own country and in the world. But I found that since I stopped listening to such programmes, not only has the world carried on, and me not listening to the Today programme has made absolutely no difference whatsoever to world events. I've also found that it's kind of removed this rather anxious, nervy way to start the day, you know. And I think newspapers do a lot of this as well. They produce a sense of anxiety and fear in you, a sense of being somehow unsafe. I mean, the idea of the war on terror and the fear of terrorism is obviously a strong example of that. You know, we're all somehow sort of destabilized. And not only does that allow certain attacks on perhaps our, you know, personal freedoms, that we're trading off for, you know, the feeling of more security, it also sort of makes us perhaps sort of work harder and consume harder.
Well,
it destabilizes.
Is idleness a philosophy of political activism? Doesn't seem to go along there.
Yeah, well, political inactivism, perhaps. I mean, the whole thing for me, it's about sort of being free, doing what you want to do. It's a book about freedom. It's a book about liberty. And when I attack work, it's not so much attacking work that you have, that you enjoy, that you've chosen to do, that's creative, you know, that's your passion, as the lady earlier said about her work. It's more when it's been sort of imposed on you by a boss and you feel like it's a sort of duty. I think if work is freely chosen, self-directed, then it can be wonderful.
If you'll allow me a little American vernacular, you endorse almost anything that will stick it to the man, including cigarettes, which a lot of people would have some problems with.
Well, again, you know, it's a question of a free choice for me. You know, I do still smoke, and I don't really want to sort of feel guilty about it. I try not to hopefully impose it on other people. But I think a little bit of moderate smoking and a little bit of moderate drinking might actually be, I mean, it sounds controversial to say smoking is good for you.
yeah, it would be controversial, but it would also be wrong.
Yeah, yeah, well, but there might be a sort of mental or relaxing benefit that perhaps outweighs the, you know, the danger, particularly if done in moderation. I'm praising the things that are attacked by, you know, let's call it straight society.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Leslie. Leslie's calling from West Bloomfield in Michigan.
Yeah, hi. How
hi.
You doing?
All right.
Okay, I miss my idle time. They were looking for somebody who doesn't have idle time. Well, that's me.
None at all.
I have a 3-year-old. The wild idle time is mommy, when you have a kid, it's the mommy who takes care of them.
And did you used to have idle time in the distant past?
Yes, I would get up in the morning. I could exercise. I could exercise in the evening, go shopping, go out for dinner, go to a movie. Now I've got a 3-year-old. Don't get me wrong. I love her to pieces. But, you know, who's the one that's there with her when she's scared at night? Who's the one that sits in rocking chair and gives her a bath and buys her clothes, buys her toys? Mommy.
Mommy.
And then my company moved to downtown Detroit, so now instead of having a 15-minute commute, I have a 50-minute commute.
Hmm.
So that, and there's nothing there that I can do my errands that I could do during lunch.
Well, the day you describe is just, you're right, it doesn't leave any time for yourself.
Right, so I get up at a little bit before 7, get her dressed, get me dressed, take her to daycare, go down to work an 8-hour day, come back home. At least my husband will make dinner, but we don't know what we went through for that one. Then I have to give her a bath, put her to bed. I'm so tired afterward, I just go straight to bed.
I don't blame you. Tom, this is the kind of life that you decry in this book.
Well, that's right.
Help it.
Yeah,
you can't help it. She's got a 3-year-old.
Well, what I'm finding, we have a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 5-month-old baby at home. We've both found it very easy since we stopped working so much. Now, what I'm finding a lot of people are doing, certainly in the UK, is that a couple are taking time out of work, or at least they're cutting down to something like a 3-day week. This results in a kind of big loss of income, but it's more than amply made up for by the extra sleep and the extra time that you have just to hang out, not in a way that costs money, but just hanging out, you know, enjoying hanging out with your kids. And we went through this very same problem 3 years ago, and then I actually retired to write the book. And I found that working at home, and my girlfriend also now works at home, we just find we have a lot more time to spend with the kids, because we can get our work done in a much shorter time, because that work, you know, the commute, the 8-hour day, you know, it's such a difficult way of organizing one's work, I think. And it's the whole job system that your caller is suffering from, really. It's the overwork, it's the expectation of having to work these very long weeks, you know. If there's a change in culture that moved around, that took work out of the center of life, and appreciated the need for a 3-hour you know, a 3-hour day, a 4-hour day, a 3-day week, job sharing, the wife and the husband, you know, sharing all of the childcare together, then I think we'd be in a healthier state, you know, because I know what it's like when you're tired and looking after children. It's terribly hard work. We gave ourselves a break. We took a big cut in income, but it was amply compensated for by the, you know, extra sleep, the ability to have a nap in the afternoon, which is really important when you've got kids.
Leslie, good luck, and hang in there.
Most American companies, though, won't let you telecommute. If I could telecommute, God, that would save me a two-hour commute.
Yeah, well, this is exactly the kind of thing that we're campaigning for, you know, and there are websites about this in the States. There's one called People for a Shorter Work Week, which is about the 32-hour week. There's something called workless.org. So, you know, there are people out there who are sort of campaigning to get the balance shifted around towards life, really, and against away from this obsession with work. Big companies need to sort of chill out, I think.
Leslie, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Robert B. Parker is one of the best-known and most prolific writers of crime fiction. He's published more than 30 novels starring the street-smart Boston private eye Spencer. His latest book, Appaloosa, a Western, comes out on June 7th. Robert Parker joins us now from his home in Boston. It's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be with you.
So how many books will you publish this year?
Probably three.
Three?
Well, the publisher's a little slow. You know, I can't help that.
And
it's the best they can do.
It's the best they can do. Do you ever have time to be idle?
Yeah, sure. I am idle every evening and every weekend.
And what do you do with that time?
Oh, I hang around, lie in the bed with the dogs, talk to public radio on the phone. You know.
and other wastes of time.
Another waste of time. I was thinking that idling away your time is what idle time is about.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started writing, I had two young children, and my wife was home, and I always decided that they came first, and I would not work nights and not work weekends, and have stuck to that even though they are now grown up and gone off and probably working nights and weekends on their own.
Hmm.
So that my idle time is infrequently is actually idle. I sit around on the front steps, see what's going on in the hood. You know, I think that the best thing that can happen to your head it's like weightlifting. You know, you lift weights one day and rest the next day so that the muscle can rebuild. And I think that idle time really ought to be idle. I mean, it ought to probably get bored before you do something.
And I wonder, in his book, Tom Hodgkinson writes about those, those delicious moments when you roll over early in the morning and those moments waking up maybe from a nap in the afternoon as maybe the times when ideas come. Is that true in your case?
No, mostly in my case, ideas come when I sit at the keyboard in front of my computer and begin.
And bleed on the keys, yeah.
Well, no, it's not that hard. I know the Red Smith used to talk about, bleeding from the forehead. But you can't. I've written 50-something books, and I don't think you could write 50 if it was painfully hard every time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, either if you can't do it, it's impossible, but if you can do it, it's not so hard.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work. I hated that.
What did you used to do for a living?
Oh, I used to be. I used to work for Curtis Wright Aircraft. I used to work for Raytheon as a tech writer. I was an industrial editor at Prudential. For a while, I went bad and became a professor, but I've straightened out. I'm not doing that anymore.
Tom Hodgkinson, you do write about writers being an unruly lot.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, I think idler is the greatest job for an idler. Writing is the greatest job for an idler. And it doesn't really sort of feel like work. I mean, every morning when I sit down at 9 o'clock to do some work, I sort of thank my lucky stars as in the same way that I don't work anymore. Writers kind of say, well, it's very, it's painful, it's difficult, you know. Well, of course, there are moments when you think, I'm not getting anywhere, how am I going to finish this chapter or whatever it is? And there are certainly moments of pain. But, I mean, compared to, working in the mines, real breeze.
Absolutely. Compared to getting up every morning, going to a job you dislike, and having to be there 8 to 10 hours and coming home at night and doing it again every day.
I
talk about when I used to work, People say, well, don't you work? And I say, yeah, sure. I mean, I put forth effort. But, I'm sitting there at my typewriter looking out the window and people are going to work. You know, it makes me smile.
I mean, I've got nothing against other people working. I love to watch them do it.
I also don't know if they have quite the same tax system in England that they have here, but Robert Parker, could you imagine what you could write off doing research on a book on how to be idle?
Spent my life at it.
Robert Parker, good luck with the new one.
Thank you very much.
Robert Parker's newest novel, a Western titled Appaloosa, comes out next week, and he was kind enough to join us from his home in Boston, where he is idling away this Memorial Day. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener on the line. Sherry's calling. Sherry's with us from Preston, Connecticut.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Hi. Well, I wanted to let you all know that I'm one of those people who supplies idle time to others. I have a small bed and breakfast inn here in Connecticut. We only have 3 guest rooms, and I've made it. I realized before I opened for business that relaxing and getting away for a weekend should not be a job. And so we have no set check-in time. We have no set breakfast time, and people are encouraged to sleep in, which doesn't happen very often anymore, because if you're not down at 8 o'clock for breakfast at a B&B or down by 10 for breakfast at a hotel, you're not getting fed. So I've done, and I also don't have a set check-out time, and I don't take bookings back-to-back. So everyone is encouraged to just lounge around, manana, and I'm up for a universal siesta time every day because I can log my work week into one weekend. I can pack 60 hours in a 3-day period.
Is your B&B one of those with the beds with such soft mattresses and so many pillows that once you're in, you have to tunnel your way out?
I have a 7-pillow minimum per bed, and that's purposeful. And you know, I like people to get up in the morning, sit in the jacuzzi, have a glass of juice, and then have breakfast. And then after breakfast, if they want to, they can go take a nap, which a lot of times they'll do. And I think it's really important. I find that my idle time ends up being during the week because I don't book during the week. Actually, technically, I'm closed right now because I needed some idle time. But, you know, it's really...
This should be a big weekend for you.
I'll tell you, no. I'm not opening again until I make some repairs from the winter. But... it's interesting that there's a niche for the way I run this business. There's also a niche for the get-up-and-goers with B&Bs. You get people who want to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they want to go, 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 and be in bed by 7. My clientele tends to be, I'm 36, within 5 years up or down of my own age. These people are so grateful to come in and not feel like they're being wrangled out of bed in the morning for breakfast. This is what they're coming away for. It's to get away from the kids that get them up at 6 a.m. It's to get them away from, you know, having to be at the job at 8 o'clock. I don't want people to look at my breakfast as a job. You know, it's a sport maybe, but not a job.
Sherry, good luck with it. And if you get it.
Thank you. And what a brilliant topic.
Thank you very much.
All
if
right,
you get a reservation from a Hodgkinson, give him the writer's discount, all right?
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you. It sounds great.
Sherry, thanks again. Here's an email we got from Rebecca in Charlotte, North Carolina. Since I'm working on this Memorial Day holiday, unfortunately, I cannot say I know how to relax. Every once in a while, I might sleep in or have an afternoon nap, but as the owner of a small business, there is little time to relax. The best solution I've found for real relaxation time is to travel to a country far away where I don't have a mastery of the language, so TV, radio, even street conversations do not filter into my mind to get bounced around. Where do I go? Turkey. Great food, wonderful people, but I cannot understand a thing they are saying. Well, I can say hello, goodbye, and get directions to the restroom. It's great. After 5 days, I don't care about American or world politics, what's happening at the office, and best yet, I get away from the Paris Hilton news. Tom Hodgkinson sounds like your kind of traveler, too.
Yeah, and you know, some of these European countries really have a different attitude to living as well. You know, not that far from England, from the UK, we have Spain and Italy, where the siesta is a hallowed part of the day. Although apparently, you know, the kind of striving ethic is starting to invade Italy. So some businesses, which used to close between 1 and 4, are starting to feel that they ought to open in order to be competitive with the guy across the street who's opening up and therefore getting more of the tourist trades. But yeah, I think anywhere you can go. But you know, you can do the. I think you can actually do this stuff at home.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're having a Memorial Day conversation about daydreaming, about skylarking, about goofing off. Our guest is Tom Hodgkinson. He's the author of the book How to Be Idle, and he joins us from BBC Studios in England. And let's get another caller on the line, and this is James. James is with us from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Hi.
Hi, James.
Very refreshing. refreshing topic. And I tell you,
James, you're fading in and out there. Let's try it again. Are we? I'm just looking in the control room. Have we lost James? We've lost James. James, I apologize for that. See if you can give us a call back. In the meantime, we will go to Roberta. Roberta's in Pendleton, Oregon. And the problem seems to be on our end and not with James or Roberta's telephones. Hold on, Roberta, just one second. See if we can get this straightened out. Tom, are you still there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, that gives me a little bit of... my heart rate has just gone down a little bit. And let's see, one more time for Roberta. Roberta, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Ah, there you are. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to echo the writer's sentiments about the value of going beyond idleness to boredom, especially for kids. You know, when we were kids, our mothers used to kick us out of the house in the summertime and say, you know, I don't want to see you until dinner, you know, and it was the best thing. I mean, obviously... things were a lot safer then, and you do that. But I think we miss a really good opportunity for kids to kind of get their brains wired for creative problem solving because we keep them occupied all the time, and we're so afraid to let them get bored beyond being idle. But I think you have to be idle first and then be bored.
And then be bored. Well, Tom Hodgkinson, one of the things that you write about in your book is the idea, not specifically for children, but for adults, to get out and take a walk.
Well, walking is just a wonderful free way to be sort of doing something but doing nothing at the same time. I mean, it can be quite hard to, you know, get out for a walk, and particularly if you've got small children. But there might be ways of injecting more walking time into your day, you know, in the lunch hour, or getting off a bit earlier on the bus, taking a different route on the way back home, you know. I found that the more sort of walking you can fit into a day, the better. There's something about the rhythm and the pace. Also, you can actually kind of physically slow down your walk and start to concentrate on, you know, the sounds and the sights that happen to you as you walk. You can actually make a conscious effort to make your walking pace more kind of relaxed and to enjoy the moment. You know, I think what idleness is about being, not doing. It's about living in the moment rather than sort of planning for the future and deferring pleasure into the future.
Roberta, did you find when you went outside as a kid that those opportunities presented themselves to you once you opened yourselves to them? Now I think Roberta's gone. Well, anyway, here's an email that suggests your seditious purpose is succeeding, Tom. As a 29-year-old teacher currently trying to grade papers and type an exam, I have found today's program on idleness drawing me toward more leisurely activities, such as sitting under the tree in my backyard and finishing the book I've been reading recently. Oh, well, at the least, thanks for helping me to infuse my work with a peaceful, leisurely pace. When you can't stop work, at least take a deep breath and don't take it so seriously. That noted, you really advocate this idea that wherever possible, idleness ought to be the goal of a life. You know, the actor you interviewed, I'm forgetting the name right now, who said, no, I don't take vacations. My whole life is vacation.
That's right. Isn't that a lovely idea that, you know, your whole life is vacation? Because when you think about a vacation, what's great about it is not always because you are simply doing nothing. It's the sense of being your own master. You know, what am I going to do today? I think, you know, I can do anything I want. I can lie in bed, I can get up, no one cares. I'm not going to feel guilty about it because I'm on vacation. If you could sort of apply that way of thinking to your whole life, yes, of course, you know, we need to earn money and we do want to do some sort of work. But perhaps there's a way of finding work which you love so much, it could hardly be called work. And then you can turn your life into a sort of total celebration of idleness. I mean, to me, it's a sort of aspiration, and it's something that I haven't really achieved. But it's very, very good fun trying to get there.
I did notice in one of your essays in your book that you mentioned that you went to France and founded a company to import absinthe into England.
That's right. But what's happened? This was one of our entrepreneurial projects, importing absinthe, and we actually successfully pulled it off. You know. Normally these schemes remain airy-fairy fantasies, but somehow the four of us friends used to talk in the pub about this idea of importing absinthe from the Czech Republic. And we actually did it, and we started a whole sort of absinthe revival. But in the middle of this, we were going to Paris to talk to some French businessmen about them making a special recipe for us. And we had a long lunch, and the lunch was going on and on and on. There was sort of snails, caviar, wine, more wine. And at a certain point, probably about 4 o'clock, I said, well, you know, do you think we ought to get down to some business? And they said, oh, travaillez plus produire moins, which means the more you work, the less you produce. Or, you know, the less you work, the more you produce was also the idea, you know. And there is this sort of idler's paradox that if you don't concentrate on work, you can actually be very productive. And I found, since I've actually celebrated my own idleness, rather than beating myself up about it, which is what I used to do as a younger person, I've actually become more productive and certainly more creative.
Tom Hodgkinson, thanks very much for joining us, and good luck with the book.
Thanks.
Tom Hodgkinson is the author of How to Be Idle. He also publishes the Idler newsletter, and he joined us from the BBC studios in Exeter, England.